let me just dive into it here. So we were just talking earlier about, I guess, the shows that you were doing down in San Diego, right? The concert series. I guess my first question there is around, like, what's your reflect? Like, I've done a little bit of stuff with live concerts, and my reflections on it are that there's just a whole nother level of stress involved with, like, live music. And I guess the question is, like, do you think that the increased level of stress that all culminates on this one evening once a year or however often it is really worth the benefit? Is it a financial thing? Is it about establishing yourself in the industry? I guess, what was your reflections or thoughts about being a part of that and doing that?
Yeah. Oh man. For me, it was like an interesting, really interesting route into it. And I got really lucky. So I had done a little bit of like work as a booking agent and then became an artist manager, mainly because I just wanted to be like as close to the artist and the artist process as possible. To me, the artist manager is like, you're the most like on the team of anybody. So I was doing that. And then when I moved to San Diego, I had realized that a lot of artists skipped the market. They kind of flew in or out of LA to start their tours. And San Diego is like a really big city, like fifth or sixth in population in the US, but there wasn't like a really rabid, you know, music going fan base, or maybe it wasn't for the genres I cared about. I don't know. So anyway, as I moved there, I was like, I just want there to be, I love nothing more, especially at that age, going to live shows. And I was just like, the bands I want to see keep skipping this market. So I'm like, I'm just going to start putting on shows here. And I started working with this venue. It was called 4th and B. It was like a 1500 cap venue, and a local guy in the market, worked with a couple of the radio stations. And I said, look, let's do an event. It's called Bring On the Bright Lights, an event series where we kind of try to get these bands that have like not come to San Diego in forever. And we convince them to come here and we make it like more of an event, even though it's part of their tour. And the first show I booked was Cut Copy.
Mute Math as well. Mute Math is so sick.
And Mute Math, yeah. And the first one with Cut, like it, I was so nervous, like putting this offer out. I was like, I don't even know if we can afford to do this. And we had to like go up and above to go with these new promoters to put the offer out, and they did it. And it like oversold out in advance. It was like this huge show and like kicked the whole thing off. And I was just lucky that it all worked out that way. But I had not realized, like, I'd been on live shows on the other end, managing artists and as an agent, but being there as the promoter and like all the little things that could go wrong, or like, what's my responsibility? I'm like making sure there's towels there for them. Like, there was so much more that had to happen in that exact moment, and wanting to make sure that like both the audience and the artist had such a good time. It was stressful, but it was, that whole series was one of the most fun things I ever did in music. But stopped doing it when I moved to LA because they didn't have quite the same problem of not getting shows.
Yeah, cool. That's really cool. There's always really good startup vibes around music. When it's like, oh yeah, well, we didn't know, but then we booked this band and then it was turned out they were really good. You know, it's really cool. So with the project that you're doing now, Dopa, there's a drop feed for upcoming drops. There's a watch list for you to add your projects. There's portfolio tracking. You can see what you're collecting. You can see what forecasts are on a future, on an album or a different kind of NFT drop. Is this just like an analytics program for music NFTs, or is there more that we're missing there from that explanation?
Yeah, great question. And I think that's a big part of it, but it's not the whole thing. So the way we look at it is huge faith and kind of belief in the potential of music NFTs and, you know, Web3 music, but it's, you know, to really kind of like change the economic paradigm for what's happening. So, you know, artists getting, you know, better remuneration, being more directly connected with their fans and community, which I've always been all about for my whole career. And then I think for fans, you know, to be, you know, directly incentivized and aligned with those artists and get, you know, awesome collectibles, things like that. But it's really obvious to me why artists would want to come in this space. But I think so far it's been a little less obvious why collectors want to come in. And I think a big part of that is it's just not easy for them to understand how this all works, how do I discover what I'm interested in? There's a lot of different platforms, and each one of them has like a slice of the pie of the artist and the songs. They all have a different value proposition. That can be overwhelming, you know, and that's aside from like the onboarding into the Web3 space to begin with. So the way we're taking the approach is just trying to find any way to make it easier on music NFT collectors to onboard into the space. So that is definitely providing analytics and predictive analytics on how songs, artists may perform, both in Web2 and how like that informs Web3, and then also how they perform in Web3 and on chain, but also discovery tools to find, you know, what are the drops you're interested in across different platforms and aggregating them into one space and making the information about those drops kind of like more uniform and easy to sort through, kind of recommendation algorithms for you or what's trending, kind of categorizing different utility for all the different drops. So making that process a lot easier. And then also building a community around that of like the best music NFT collectors who are learning about the space and providing a lot of education for them, especially like from platforms to come in and explain, you know, how's the best way to interact with, say, another block? What's coming up on our roadmap? What are some other giveaways or in real life things we can do for these kind of like really big music supporters? So for us, it's like the place you want to go to first if you're a collector coming into the space to learn about the space and what's going on and never miss anything.
Yeah, wow. That's amazing. Okay, so could we talk about the first element there, which is maybe the aggregation of drops? And then obviously we need to dive a little bit into the research component at some point. But is that something that, how if someone's going to drop an album, let's say an artist is going to drop an album on another block, how are you notified of that? Is there some sort of like back-end connection that you're establishing with these companies, or is it manual entry at this point? Like how does that working now, or how do you foresee that working in the future?
Yeah, the answer is a combination. So, okay. You know, we have our own kind of input API that, you know, we're working with different platforms to utilize. And that's kind of our ideal way of bringing things in because it has all of the information we need in the way that we need it. With other platforms, they maybe have their own API they're already using to bring into their own data feed, and they're giving us keys to access that. You know, there's every single one of those is different, requires us to make different transformations of that data into the way we need it to look like on our discovery feed. Then there is some level right now of manual input on a few just to make sure there's nothing we're missing. Once things are fully on chain, you know, then like we're just grabbing that from, you know, a few different places and pulling that in. So like once the drops have actually minted and now they're live.
Yeah, right. That makes a lot of sense.
You mentioned that in one of the articles that you wrote, that I remembered how to talk.
You mentioned pretty early. It's like 6:30 here, so a little bit of grace.
So you mentioned in one of the articles about the one of the biggest unsolved issues is actually discoverability at the moment, and how Web3 needs to solve the discoverability issue around music. So can Doper actually solve the discoverability issue, or is this something that's a bit more external?
We're hopefully solving part of it, you know, and it's in the works for sure. You know, I think part of it is that you have like this disparate platform system I'm talking about. So it's making that a lot easier, you know, just knowing what's happening, you know, also giving the ability to follow artists you care about that have maybe even never released yet on chain and getting notifications when they do release something. So making some of those like really basic discovery mechanisms easier, kind of organizing things and giving you alerts for stuff you care about, making sure that you're seeing, you know, what is the genre of these artists and what is the utility type they're working on and different kind of analytics. So, you know, if we're looking at, say, some of this goes into the analytics for the discovery. So if we're looking at, you know, thousands of an open platform that has no curation and thousands of artists that are releasing tens of thousands of NFTs on there, and you go onto that platform and it's just like, here's everything, good luck. You know, that's a really difficult process. So for us, we take that and we actually look at the audio, we look at what the artists are doing on and off chain, we look at the type of release, and we both organize the information for you but then also provide predictive analytics on how we think some of these are going to perform, kind of make gradings on some of the songs, and then eventually we'll be doing some kind of recommendation algorithms that are tied to your wallet. But when we do that, it'll be optional that you can either have an algorithm or not have an algorithm and how it's delivered to you.
Yeah, wow. Okay, so it sounds like there's a combination here. There is, I guess, curation based on your preference. And that's something we've seen before on Spotify and stuff like that. And it's what people are used to. And it's probably going to make them feel familiar with the platform. And then there's this new element, which I'm going to make myself look silly by trying to explain and ask a question about it, which is the research component of what you've done, which it's really worth diving into just so people understand, I guess, the technicalities behind this. It's not just an API connected to the back end of all of these, royalty distribution platforms. It's way more than that. And so let's dive into that. And so it looked to me like that there's an article that maybe you wrote with, I think the co-founders maybe of the business that you started seem to be really heavily into this space, which sounds like a great combination between you guys. And so you talk about how dopamine response to certain tensions and release in music or patterns of tension and release in music can basically identify whether or not someone's going to enjoy the music. And if they're going to enjoy the music, then naturally we're going to expect it to be a future hit. And so then I guess you expect it to perform better. Is that sort of a simple explanation? How would you sort of explain that better?
So that's actually like a pretty, pretty strong phrasing of it. So
okay, thank you.
To mention I'm music industry background guy, totally. Whereas okay. My two co-founders, Dave and Scott, are both yep. cognitive neuroscientists. Wow. And for both of them, their focus is on how we form music preference in the brain. And a lot of their research showed, they phrased it as familiar surprise, which is a lot of the tension and release that you're talking about. So it shows that like the different memory systems in our brain, they kind of desire a level of familiarity when we're listening to songs. So it's based on patterns we've heard before or all the music we've heard before from our childhood. And it's kind of playing on that nostalgia and like what our expectations are to come next. But we also want there to be these kind of surprising moments that challenge our expectations in just the right way on top of it and are really pleasing to us when that happens. And then when we go back and we listen to that music again, what was previously surprising is now familiar, and we're anticipating that moment, and it's really, really gratifying when it comes up, and I kind of knew it was gonna come up. So this kind of happens like within the song itself and between songs, and it's always changing over time. They call it like inflationary surprise. So we find that actually music needs to get more and more surprising over the decades because we've all heard the previous music. And this kind of even happens like month to month, like whatever the big hit was last month is gonna affect what all of our expectations are globally, but like specific to that genre for what's going to happen next. So we've taken, this is one of many different insights around this, but we've kind of measured surprise in bits, in songs, in like all different kinds of measurables. So, dynamic surprise, harmonic surprise, rhythmic surprise, and there's different ideas of like what's optimal for how surprise is represented across different songs. So maybe you want to have like a lot of dynamic surprise like right before the chorus, but then when the chorus comes in, you want that dynamic surprise to drop. And it's all kind of levels of where that works out. So we've taken that and we've looked at like millions of songs that we've looked at the audio, and we're using surprise metrics as well as many other metrics to kind of predict its success. And we've looked at songs over the last 30 years, and then specifically like more narrowly over the last couple years, and kind of looked at, what is the trend in surprise in each different kind of micro genre and for different audiences that represents the most success. So what we're trying to do is do this in a few different ways. I mean, some of the models look at, how a song is going to perform in like traditional Web 2 metrics. So how much sheer volume of streams is a song going to get, which is a great way to look at it. It's an easy metric to utilize, and we can kind of like appraise the value of songs. And it's not a crystal ball. It's a probabilistic model. So like, it's a one, we can kind of see like the 99th percentile outcome, the 1 percentile outcome of a track. But what we're looking at next, and what I'm really excited about is kind of using metrics that show like the level of engagement or the level of love and attachment to a song or artist based off of these things. So that we're not just measuring, like a lot of people may passively kind of like this and the volume of streams go up, but how many people are going to like fall in love and this is going to be their favorite song and they're going to become a big fan. So that's kind of our big next goal on what we're doing for the modeling of this information.
So yeah, so we've got the optimal level of surprise there. We've got the tension and release. We've got expectations changing over time. So my question is, what is the perfect song? And how?
Oh yeah, which is the perfect song?
Yeah, which one is it?
Because baby, it's Baby Baby by Justin Bieber.
I want to invest in that one.
The world has proven that, right? I don't know.
Well, it's interesting.
A little shock.
And I'll share. It probably is. Well, it's so funny. We got into a conversation yesterday about how, like, actually, nursery rhymes and what you listen to as a kid, and it's different culturally, but like has such a large effect on what your expectations are for music and how things build off that later in your life. My co-founders, they did a study a couple years ago, it just came out last year, about the inflationary surprise thing. So what they did was they looked at like all the top, it wasn't every song. So this was like the top Billboard charting songs of the last like 30, 40 years. And it was examining how like, the songs that performed the best, they were showing more and more surprise than the songs years prior. But the song that had performed like the most optimally was Childish Gambino. Was it This Is America is the title of the song? Was like the, yeah, and that was song. Kind of the year it ended, the study it ended as well.
Yeah, wow. I fly into America every now and then to do some stuff. And so every time I fly in, I listen to that song because it's like, oh, this is so nostalgic and cool. Go. So that's interesting. Okay, so question is, it looks like when you're valuing, so let's say, for example, you've used your model and you've determined what you think the number of streams a song's going to get based on the engagement that is going to come out of the characteristics, the sonic characteristics of the song. I guess it sounds to me to a certain extent like you're then valuing it, the future dividends or the royalty payments in today's value. Like, okay, what's that today? What's that worth today? But then I was thinking like do you include a secondary transaction component to it? And then I was thinking, well, how would you value that? And I guess my head was going towards, it's all about what their demographic is willing to pay for it in the future. And I was thinking, if you've got a younger artist who has a lot of Web3 literate followers, there's likely going to be more demand for that. And so maybe it's going to push the price up. But if it's an older artist with the same sonic characteristics of the song, similar streams, their fan base might just not be on there and they might get, it just might not be pushed up to the same level. Is that something you've sort of thought about? What's your response there?
So interesting. I mean, it's something we're working on now is more of kind of, we kind of divide it like on-chain, off-chain, right? So it's like off-chain, we feel very strongly about where we're at with that. And we think that informs quite a bit of on-chain. I mean, you would imagine that if an artist is going to get more and more popular over the next couple of years, if this song that's you know within a track, whether even if it's not a royalty bearing NFT, you would imagine if that song ends up being a huge hit, that's going to increase the value, right? But then you've got on chain, which is a combination of you know what type of NFT is it, what other value is associated with it, who else holds it. Maybe even what platform is it coming from? Do they get a lot more attention? What's the transaction volume that's already happening on it? You know, what world do they sit in terms of genre and like their demographic, like you're mentioning? But you could even think of things in a different way. So this goes back to like, okay, how passionate are those fans? So like there may be somebody who has more streams than another artist, but they have like a much stronger connection with their fans. You know, you have lots of artists who have more streams than others, but they sell far fewer tickets than someone else. I think of the band Phish, you know, right? Like they're not going to get a lot of streams, but they're going to have like an 80,000 person music festival they throw on their own. If they put out an NFT, those fans are going to pay anything for it. So, you know, we look at like a band like to go with the same jam band model, like a Grateful Dead. You know, they may not have as much like total volume metrics, but there's like this diehard fan mentality. So we're trying to figure out, you know, some of that's on chain, some of that's going back to the web too. And it's like, can we take touring data and merch data and some other types of information that are maybe closer proxies to like how much dedication someone has towards an artist. What is the fan base kind of like, right? And so for us, we look at that and we say like, that can predict how we think these NFTs are can perform, but maybe it can also help artists understand how they should price their NFTs as well. And kind of like dividing their fan bases and saying, we think that, you know, they're willing to pay X based on, you know, their level of engagement. I hope that answers the question.
No, that's amazing. That's amazing insight, what you just went through there. The merch idea, everything like that. So good.
So yeah, so you've talked about before that how utility is everything, and how you go on there to talk about the various types of NFTs that each project is offering. You've got one of ones, royalty bearing NFTs, community access, avatars. What type of NFT are you most excited about coming up on your platform?
It's a good question. I think we're figuring out so much about utility. I think like, to me, the most obvious is royalty bearing. And I hope other people are kind of like really getting that as well. And I give like the example that an artist that I managed, like we sold a part of their catalog, their streaming catalog a few years ago. So like a more traditional music industry player. And it was a good deal and we're happy. And the band received a bunch of money. They're not really going to do anything with it. It's just like an annuity. But it's over. That transaction ended. And like, there was nothing beneficial about it except for the money. And I look at like what's available now through platforms like Another Block, in that like we could have done a similar transaction, but interacted directly with our fans and let them come on board with what we're doing. And we could have had other perks we gave to them. We could have, and then we could have like had this token connection with them, where now the next thing we do, we say, hey, if you own one of those tokens, you're going to be invited into this. Like, it opens up possibilities that whatever you want to do. And on top of that, there's the secondary sales. So if they had made any secondary sales, the band, this isn't the end of the financial transactions of that sale. So for that reason, and like for me as an artist manager, like that is so obvious why I see the most obvious how like everyone wins there, as long as the artists aren't getting, the fans aren't getting screwed over. What I say is like, there's this artist been so mad, they feel like the industry has like kind of screwed them. Everything's been behind a black box. The pricing mechanisms haven't been fair for them. So let's not take this like really great thing where we can like have them connected with artists and then they do that to the fans. Right? It's like they need to treat fans where like the pricing on the deal should be the same that an industry player, like the same multiple that an industry player. So everyone can actually win and you're not just using your name to like take money in. So that's my opinions of like the royalty bearing. Otherwise, I feel like it's more of just bringing fans into your world. So it's like the interoperability. So like, I don't know that it's any one thing. To me, I look at it as like, I think artists need to like fully jump in and have like a Web3 plan that's like, if we're going to do one thing, we're going to do 100 things. And I'm going to release this song on this platform and this song on this platform with this different use case. But if you've ever bought any of our other tokens, that allows you access into like this kind of like home base that's token gated, where we're giving you other things. And then whenever we're doing tour pre-sales, owning, being involved here gets you, you know, first access. Then when you come to the show, there's a behind, you know, backstage it's available to, like, to me, it's about gathering, like what you do across the ecosystem should all unlock something like central to you as an artist. I keep trying to get my artists on board with that. And it's just like an education process that like there needs to be full buy-in. So to me, it's like royalty bearing, and otherwise I'm like, I'm not really seeing any of the utility that I feel like is as fully realized yet in its own right.
Yeah, right. That's cool. It sounds to me like you're sort of saying that a lot of artist management companies probably need to start hiring people who can specialize in Web3 strategic plans, in the way that they have people who are doing marketing and doing all of the other elements that are required. It needs to be a service that's offered on top of other stuff. And that's really interesting. Question specifically about one of the categories within there. I saw it. It's called generative. Do you know anything about these sort of NFTs? Could you explain it? It's something that I actually haven't dived into and literally would be learning from what you're saying right now.
I feel like I'm like not the best person to tell you. It's funny because Dave, my co-founder, was like, actually, like we were getting more into generative today because he was talking about the transaction volume on generative NFTs seems to be significantly higher than anything else. I think because like it lends itself to more of like the art and PFP NFT collection idea, because like I noticed something like that. There's a company called Soundmint, and they're doing some really interesting stuff where like they're getting an artist, a musical artist, and the visual artist, and they're combining. And I think the artist is putting together stems, and the visual artist is putting together like an original piece of artwork. And then they're using some, you know, generative AI to make like variations of both that then get paired together. And then now you can have like a 5,000, 10,000 unit collection, which I think is really like interesting in how it lends itself to like that art PFP collection level. There's also one called Async that does something similar where you're taking stems from the artist and there's like variations of the stems. I guess it maybe isn't as much generative, but like then users can, they own a different stem. So like I own the bass stem, this person has the drum stem, and like you choose which of the versions is the live version, and that unlocks like the only listenable version of the song. Which I don't know that, I guess that's not generative, but I found interesting. But there seems to be like a lot in that space, and I'm trying to figure out what the use cases are, but they lend themselves to like way higher output.
Yeah, that's cool. So do you guys have, on those generative ones, I've used a platform previously called nftgo.io, which was very good for seeing. You could see volume. You could see, how many buyers and sellers are there. You could see a lot of those financial metrics. Is there going to be anything that shows that level of rarity of each NFT? Is there going to be something that you can kind of see on a generative AI? Oh, this factor is more rare. This factor is less rare. These are the 20% common, you know, like, is it going to be something there or?
It's funny you're asking that. So that's like exactly where Dave and I's conversation went today, because, and so like, this is literally a conversation from today about how we could do exactly what you're saying on generative music, because for one thing, we are going to have some of that, those analytics that are like on-chain transaction volume. But in looking at like a 10,000 unit generative song output, what we'd love to be able to do is analyze all of those songs and say, A, like this is what's different about them and provide that rarity, but also actually say like, this is the best one, you know? And like, it's hard to like, you know, even with 1,000 PFPs, you can look through them, that's hard, but like it's faster to look at something. So listen to a 3 or 4 minute piece of music, and you're not going to do that with 1,000 of them with anything that's AI at scale. So like having the ability for something to listen through and say like, these are the most desirable versions of the song. I'm hoping there could be like value to that and saying like, there's actually like a ranking to them. Hopefully that like provides value and it's not like, shit, I got.
Yeah, definitely.
10,000, this sucks. So we're trying to figure out a way that makes it positive around the bend.
Could you just use your AI model to just make the perfect songs?
I wish. I mean, we've done a lot of talks with like generative companies that like no kind of like qualitative, it's just like a fire hose, right? So like it's good for like idea generation, but like so much of it is garbage. And we're talking to them, this is like less in the Web3 space, but just like we're the quality control. So like when 100,000 songs come out, we're like, these are the 500 that like are actually worth listening to, and it works a lot better in that than the creation of the music.
So when you've got, so on your platform, you've got 136 organizations. How do you find the best projects to include, or do they come to you, or what are you choosing?
262 platforms today. So, wow. Which is nuts. It's just nuts to how many platforms. So all of those, that's pretty much what we're putting on like the Music NFT Resource Directory. Is anything we find or that really gets submitted to us that has some vetting to it, that essentially we're just making sure it's not a scam or a rug pull. And if we feel it's not a scam or a rug pull, we're willing to put that on there, and you can search for it and find what's valuable or interesting to you that's totally free and not behind any kind of sign-in wall. Not every platform that's on there will be in like our platform of discovery feed. That, you know, was starting with a smaller group of platforms that we believe, A, every single artist and release that comes through them is 100% authenticated. And there's a level of curation at first. So we'll be starting with about 15 platforms that come through the discovery feed and then very quickly ramping up from there.
Yeah, wow. That's amazing. As we start to wrap up, because we're sort of starting to head towards the 30-minute mark here, I guess my question was around you and the way you operate. It sounds like you started a label, you started a management, you know, company, you started, you're promoting and producing events. And then now this sort of Web3 style stuff. There's a lot of stuff that you've done up until now, you know? And so the question is like, I noticed on, I think it was in like your bio on LinkedIn, you talked about, you felt like your specialization was taking something from zero to one, from nothing to reality. Is that still the case? Did you get that idea from Zero?
And, I've never read that book. Although, really? Like, everyone around me has told me things about it, which is like, yeah.
What are the certain characteristics around how you operate that make you great in that space of business and structure?
I think for me, I'm just attracted to it, for one. And it's just like the most exciting wins come from that space. So like I've been running my own businesses since I was 22. I've just like, it's been one to the next. So it's always getting those from zero to one. And then I just love working with, I've loved working with like independent artists, like really early stage and trying to, the hardest thing to get to is like, nobody cares. So like, wow, like enough people care where this is a career. And to me, that's the most exciting moment when like you're managing an artist or have had an artist on the label and it gets from like hobby to like, this is my life now. So I think for me, it's just like that motivates me more than anything else. So it's just like building a team for them, finding the other people that like are the evangelists around that artist or for a company or the evangelist around that company and like experimenting and being able to like break things and move really fast so that like you can quickly find like whether it's company, it's the product market fit, or if it's the artist, it's just like, what's our strategy in getting like growing fans and connecting with people. So for me, it's like, you can try out the most ideas, I think really early on. And if you fail, it's okay. You just move to the next thing.
So speaking of product market fit there, you were saying that Web3 needs to be attractive to both collectors and to creators. So how can a platform attract the best creators and the best collectors? And how can they maintain them on a project sustainably?
Oh, man, it's a tough one. I mean, I think like a really good value prop to both sides, really good UI. And really to me in this space, it's like, really easy onboarding and education. I mean, like I manage artists that I'm trying to explain why Web3 makes sense for them and they just glaze over sometimes. So like, and I think for me, what's been good is like, you know, looking at a platform or two, but like, well, go to, this is like their how-to as an artist, right? So like having like the best onboarding and educational tools and systems to make them understand like, what is the value for me to do this? And how can you make it as simple for me as possible? I don't think we're doing that as enough on like the collector end. I think right now, most of the strategies are like, well, if the artists are here, the collectors will come. And I think that works to a degree, but like the barrier of entry is, to be honest, that actually like hasn't worked much historically in the music industry. Like a ton of companies have tried that. And like, even like, you know, like Apple Music and Tidal and stuff tried like these wars of doing like album premieres early on. And it really wasn't that sustainable. And I think you have to like directly be reaching out to those artists and explaining to them, like, why is this new thing I have to sign up for and learn about like actually going to be meaningful to me? In addition to just like the day, you know, an artist I care about tells me that I have a drop there. Like there has to be like a direct, meaningful, like they have to understand the value of caring about your platform. I don't know if that's a great way of saying it, but I feel like there's not enough like direct education, onboarding, and like explaining the value prop to a collector aside from like, this is patronage.
Yeah, right. That makes a lot of sense. I think maybe I've frozen on your video, but don't be too stressed about it. okay, so I guess as we wrap, first of all, thank you so, so much for your time. Like, the project is so cool. And I think hopefully we've done our best to try and present, you know, the underworkings and the things that make what you're doing so, so interesting and so unique. And so hopefully it's worked and you've said what you wanted to say. But if people are really interested in the project, how can they find out more? I noticed that they can jump on the website and maybe get possible access to like a beta version or whatever. Could you talk a bit about more of that? More about that.
Yeah, no, totally. We're launching our Discord community in a couple weeks. And right now you can either go follow us on Twitter at doper_AI or go to our website. And if it does say sign up for early access, a big part of what that's going to be is like kind of bringing you into our Discord a little bit early. There's gonna be a lot of kind of community aspects of what we're doing. There'll be some extra value for getting in there early. And then when we do launch the kind of doper discovery product in July, the people who have come in early are going to have early beta access to that as well. So if you go sign up right now on that early access list on our doper.xyz, you'll be able to get in there a little bit earlier than everybody else.
Amazing. Well done. Thank you so much for your time. And is there anything else? How can people find out about you specifically and what you're doing?
Yeah, yeah. Twitter.
Yeah.
Is at AbelowRob, A-B-E-L-O-W Rob. And I'm on there every day.
Sick, man. But thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.